You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, knowing how to pose in a photograph is hard. For me, anyway. But a local photographer gives us some advice and tricks to make it easier for your summer graduations, weddings, and family get-togethers. You probably heard the notion that under the U.S. tax system, everybody pays their fair share and that the richest Americans pay the most. According to a new report, that may not be the case. ProPublica got a hold of some IRS data on the tax returns of thousands of the wealthiest Americans. The list includes Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, investors Warren Buffett, George Soros, and Carl Icahn, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, and more. The information shows that over the past 15 years, some of them have paid relatively little federal income tax, and some years, none. Nobody's being accused of doing anything illegal. They're just taking advantage of the way the tax code works. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this? Were you upset or shocked to find out that the very rich avoid paying much in the way of income taxes in many cases? Or are these features a good thing? Because they spur investment, economic growth, charitable giving. Are there changes you think need to be made? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeff Ernsthausen is a senior data reporter at ProPublica. He worked on this tax story. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little more, Jeff, about this data you got, all this IRS information? What did you end up with?
So as you mentioned, we have tax records on thousands of the wealthiest individuals for over 15 years. We're talking the 1% of the 1%, including household names like you mentioned, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and so on.
What stood out to you the most as you started to dig into the numbers?
Well, what we featured in our first story, which ultimately is about a very basic concept, right? And that's that you and I, and most listeners out there, when we work to live, we earn wages or a salary, and tax are taken automatically out of that each month, right? The ultra wealthy are not in the tax system the same way. So the bulk of their wealth as it grows is not taxed until they choose to do something like, say, sell stock. And so what we observed is that they're able to accrue vast wealth and not pay a lot in taxes on it. And interestingly, as you pointed out, in some years, some of the country's wealthiest individuals were able to pay zero in federal income taxes.
And the key question here in a lot of ways, in a lot of these stories, is what is income? As you mentioned, for a lot of us, that's our paycheck. But a lot of times we'll read a rich person, their net worth went up X amount last year, something like that. A lot of times that isn't what is considered income for income tax purposes. Why not?
That's right. You know, for the average person, income is really the operative thing, right? I mean, you might get some growth in the value of a relatively small stock portfolio or in the value of your house, but most of what you're bringing in, so if you think about it economically, is an income that the IRS recognizes through wages. It's completely flipped for people who are the wealthiest in this country. So the vast majority of what they're bringing in is never income as specified by the IRS. And so when you take that fuller picture of, you know, the economic value that people can tap into, you see that the ultra wealthy are paying a really low rate.
And now people might think, okay, great. Your stocks went up this year. You don't get taxed on that, but you're eventually going to pay the price, right? Because you're going to sell those stocks sometime and it'll all catch up. Does it tend to work out that way?
Not necessarily. So there are ways that folks can, especially at the top of the wealth spectrum, can work to kind of minimize how they'll end up paying taxes. So first is if income happens at a time of your choosing, you can also do things that can offset it at that time, right? So you can do things like time your charitable deductions in the years when you want to sell stocks so that you can reduce that income and reduce the taxes paid on it. And one might think, well, eventually there's going to be, you know, estate taxes paid, let's say. People at the very top of the wealth spectrum can also find ways around that. They can use certain kinds of trusts to pass assets on without paying the estate tax. And ultimately, you know, some folks may decide to, you know, give everything to charity, which may fund some noble causes, but also means that their the wealth that they accumulated may never actually end up getting taxed.
Talking to Jeff Ernsthausen, senior data reporter at ProPublica. He was part of the team that analyzed tax information, IRS information about many, some thousands of the wealthiest Americans, found that a lot of them pay very small amounts of income tax and some years no income tax. You could join in with your thoughts on this or your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you see this as a problem? If so, what changes do you think need to be made? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeff, you also, in this piece, you and your colleagues lay out a strategy. If I have tons of assets and stocks and other things like this, and I want to spend lots of money but not get an income, there's a people borrow the money. Talk about how this works.
Yeah, and it's a part of what you mentioned earlier, sort of how does this work if you don't have income, right? So the thing is that just like a typical, you know, person might borrow against their house and take out a home equity loan, the ultra wealthy can borrow against their stock portfolios. And the most prominent example of that would be, Elon Musk. So Elon Musk, through disclosures made to the SEC by Tesla, we know that Elon Musk borrowed against $60 billion in shares of Tesla. So even though someone may not be selling and therefore getting an income that way, they still have access to those resources. And rather than taking a, you know, maybe 20% capital gains hit and losing control of part of the company, they may pay a single digits interest rate to a bank.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Slinger. Mike, hi.
Hey, afternoon, guys. I read your article in the Journal yesterday. It was pretty good. I was really impressed on what they pay on all that money, 1.3%, 1.some percent compared to my 34%. Or used to be. I'm retired now. But did you do any further? Did you go further down the ladder to people that are making $2 million, $3 million, $10 million, $20 million, $60 million instead of the billionaires? Just curious. And I'll take your answer. Thank you.
Mike, thanks for the call. Jeff, the people who aren't the super billionaires but still have a decent amount of cash, how far down did your data go?
Well, I'm not able to comment on how far down our data went. I will say that, so we focused on the top, the wealthiest folks in the country, the folks that we would be able to get data from Forbes on in terms of where their wealth was. Now, the IRS does publish information for people who are further down in the income spectrum. And what that data shows is that, the amount of taxes you pay as a share of what you take in an income tends to rise steadily until you get into the, I think you start pushing past 1 or 2 million, you start getting more like 10 or beyond million, then you start to see a dip as people are making more in capital gains and things that receive a lower rate than say wages or other kinds of income.
Mike, thanks a lot for that question at 800-642-1234. So, Jeff, an important point here, and at least in what you've published so far, none of what we're talking about is illegal, right? It's taking advantage of the system as it exists.
Yeah, that's right. Our first story here has been entirely about legal sort of routine techniques for tax avoidance and the way that the ultra wealthy are able to organize their affairs to avoid taxes in ways that are not available to typical Americans.
And another point some people are raising, and some of your colleagues at ProPublica actually published a piece on the ethics of this. Somewhere along the line, somebody broke the law to put this data that you're using out into the public. What kind of questions are you asking inside ProPublica about how and whether to use this information?
Well, I would say that we've been very careful in what we are reporting. So we're not, we haven't put everything we have up on the internet, right? We do think that it's relevant with the wealthiest Americans, those who control over $1 trillion in wealth and some of the largest household companies in the country. We think it's relevant what they pay in taxes. I think that our discussion is focused on what is of the public interest.
We are talking about taxes and what the wealthy do or don't pay when it comes to income tax. Jeff Ernsthausen is a senior data reporter at ProPublica, part of the team that analyzed this tax information on, you know, household names like Jeff Bezos, Warren Buffett, and Elon Musk, and a lot of other people. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to what you're hearing, what you read, if you took a look at the pieces so far? Do you think tax codes need to change, including maybe taxing unrealized income? When somebody's wealth goes up thanks to stocks, say, or other assets, should we have a wealth tax of some sort in this country? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a new report from ProPublica that dives into how the richest Americans pay little, or in some years, no federal income tax. The report found that Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, now the world's richest man, paid no income taxes in 2007, 2011 as well. Others have managed to pull that off in recent years. Nothing illegal here, but ProPublica says the IRS data paints a picture of a tax system that in many ways can be skewed in favor of the wealthiest Americans. Jeff Ernsthausen stays with us, senior data reporter at ProPublica, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Good afternoon, gents. I always wondered why we don't have a national sales tax, because even the ultra-wealthy buy things at, like, you know, $80 million yachts and expensive cars and expensive jewelry. So to me, that would be part of the solution. They can't really get out of that.
Jimmy, thanks a lot for the call. And in the piece, Jeff, you and your colleagues looked at some alternatives that would bring in more taxes from the wealthiest. Is this something people are talking about, some kind of national sales tax, consumption tax, luxury tax, whatever you want to call it?
Sure. Thanks for that question. I think that's something that people are talking about. Interestingly, if you sort of step back and look at all the taxes paid by people across the income spectrum, sales taxes tend to land a bit heavier on people further down the spectrum, because we tend to pay more of our, you know, people have to spend more money just to of a bigger share of their income just to pay for the necessities of life, right? So somebody who has to spend every dime they earn is going to pay whatever it is, 6% or whatever the state sales tax is on that. That said, I'm sure it's possible to come up with a design to where one could potentially omit certain kinds of necessities from a sales tax system in order to make it fall a little less heavily on people further down the income spectrum.
Thanks a lot for that call. Now, one response to your piece comes from Jonah Goldberg, conservative columnist. He said, in effect, tax loopholes, what people call loopholes, were written to encourage things like investment and charitable giving. So, yes, we're not getting the income tax, but the benefits end up balancing that out. I know you don't necessarily take a policy position in your writing, but what do you make of that argument and that response?
Yeah, I mean, to be sure, charitable giving does a lot of good. And you know, I think what our article is doing is not necessarily focused on telling you whether all of this is good or bad. It's sort of giving people the information that they need in order to make an informed sort of decision or debate about tax policy in this country. I will note that one of the interesting things we got back when we reached out to Warren Buffett was that he noted that he would rather give his money away to charity than have it pay down part of the national debt. Now, as one might note, that's not necessarily an option for everyone, because we pay taxes right away when we receive a paycheck.
Let's go back to our callers now. Bob is with us in northern Wisconsin. Bob, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bob?
Well, yeah, the fact is the stock market thing going up, and people are making money out of right now, but that's because they brought money back from overseas with the tax breaks that the Republicans come up with recently. And what they're doing is they're driving the stock prices up by buying the stock back, rather than putting all this money coming back in the country into the company's well-being and helping the country out grow industry again.
I gotcha, Bob. Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, a lot of attention, I think, on stock buybacks. And that reminds me of something in your piece, Jeff. A lot of people whose income grows heavily, it's growing, or they're not, their wealth grows. It grows because of the stock they hold in their own company, even if they're only making a salary, an income of $60,000 a year or $1 a year or whatever the case might be.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon. There's been this phenomenon of CEOs taking relatively low pay, and in some cases that's sort of celebrated as a virtue. I mean, one of the other virtues of it is that you also are not getting wage income, which would be taxed at the highest rate. So in some ways, the compensation of CEOs is very much a part of this story, because if you're compensated in stock and that stock grows, and especially if it's a stock that's not paying dividends, then there's not going to be a whole lot of taxes paid on that wealth as you accumulate it.
Thanks for the call, Bob, at 800-642-1234. Jeff Ernsthausen is with us, senior data reporter at ProPublica, looking at ProPublica's latest pieces, more to come based on a bunch of information, tax information on many of the wealthiest Americans, and showing that they pay little or in some years no income tax, many of them. Jeff, as far as policy ideas that float around Wisconsin, in national politics in Washington, are people saying, hey, we should tax these unrealized gains? If you make a lot of wealth gains in the stock market, say you might be taxed on that?
There are some proposals to that effect. I believe Senator Ron Wyden has sort of talked about doing this, and there's some sort of folks who have worked out some technical details of how that would work, right? And one of the concerns people always raise is, well, this would, I'd have to sell my company or sell part of my company. But, you know, as with most things, technical solutions are always out there to figure out these kinds of problems if one's so inclined.
Time for another caller now. Bill is with us in West Bend. Bill, hello.
Hello. No. The discussion earlier about a federal income tax, if they instituted, say, 1% or 2% federal income tax, but gave a refund to people under a certain income level, that would help equalize it and put the burden towards the higher income people.
And Bill, did you mean that we were talking earlier about a federal sales tax? We already have the
federal sales tax.
Gotcha.
Sorry,
okay.
A federal sales tax.
I figured that's what you meant. Thanks for the clarification, Bill. I appreciate that. So Bill raising the idea of, yes, everybody pays a sales tax, but you get rid of that, I guess, the regressive concern you brought up, Jeff, by rebating to people with lower income. Might work, but it sounds more complicated than just a straight-up sales tax.
Yeah, but that's, I think, as your caller just pointed out, that's, you know, among the solutions that I think people kind of come up with is, you know, when trying to figure these things out, is on the one hand, you could put a flat rate in and pay some people back if they're at a certain part of the income spectrum. So it's certainly among the technical things that people might talk about.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bill. One thing I wanted to dive in on a little closer, Jeff. Jeff Bezos, in a couple of years, was able to claim the child tax credit, the one, the earned income credit, I think, that's mainly geared toward lower income people. Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah. How did he do that?
Well, I mean, in that year, his income was so low that he was able to qualify for that. And it would seem that either he or a very attentive tax attorney noticed that and claimed it.
I want to look ahead, Jeff, now, and I assume you're going to play a little close to the vest in terms of what data you're sitting on there. And but that said, what can we look forward to in your reporting on these documents in the upcoming weeks?
Well, absolutely, we're going to continue reporting based on these, and I can't get into the exact stories, of course, but I think we're continuing to look at ways in which the system is skewed in ways that favor the wealthiest among us.
Jeff, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Jeff Ernsthausen, senior data reporter at ProPublica. We talked to him today about ProPublica's reporting on how the richest Americans managed to pay relatively little, if anything, in some years in income taxes. Still time for you to share your reactions to that reporting from what you've heard now, or if you've read it, you could head over and share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page and what, if anything, you think needs to change in our tax system, or to make the case that this is working as designed and you don't have a problem with it. Again, share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can always email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new history exhibit in Neenah tells the story of immigrants to the city going back almost 200 years. We'll hear about their experiences and what drew them to Wisconsin. Now, summer is a time for graduations, family get-togethers, spending time with friends, and something a lot of us try to do when we get together is take some pictures. For some of you, posing for a picture may come as naturally as breathing, but I know posing for a picture is a skill because I don't have that skill. Marla Berg is a portrait and product photographer in Madison and Chicago. She owns and operates a photo studio in downtown Madison where she photographs family photo sessions, images for marketing campaigns and editorial pieces, headshots, and more. Marla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, I got to know, does it seem to you as a pro, like some people are just more natural at posing in photographs than others?
You know, I would say yes. Some people are a little less inhibited, so they are more likely to be kind of extroverted and go with it. And other people a little more reserved and are looking at the camera as like an enemy. So it can go either way.
Now think about the worst person who's ever posed for you, and then subtract some, and you got me. How would you advise those people in my category to, I don't know, just to relax and feel a little more natural, first of all?
Well, okay. So I don't think you're as bad as you think you are, and that is probably the problem, is you're more than likely in your head, and you need time to warm up to the camera. So that can be with a photographer, that could be with a friend, that could be with an iPhone session. You need to find a way to warm up to the camera and warm up to the photographer. And if you don't have that time, I would suggest you practice in the mirror, just kind of casually at home, just practice posing.
And that, I don't know, does that work? Because, you know, the mirror has that reverse image thing. I feel like I look different in photos versus mirrors. Does that really help?
It does help because you're not really looking for what you will look like, you're kind of trying to hone in on how you want to feel. And that is what translates through the photo. So the mirror practice just kind of gets you used to, putting weight on one foot or turning to the side, learning what your best side is. Maybe you don't like your nose when, you're looking up. So learning how you feel in the mirror will help you in front of the camera, because then you can kind of guide the person and say, you know, don't shoot at that angle, or give me a second. I got to turn this way.
Now, for a posed picture, some people have that natural smile. Some people have that really forced smile. How can we make ourselves smile naturally?
Well, there's two ways you can approach this. If you're working with a non-professional, so amateur, or just a family member, what I would do is I would just have a conversation. And then just talk it through and find a way to laugh or fake laugh. If you fake laugh or genuinely laugh, you'll get some sort of smile that's close to reality. When someone tells you to say cheese or tells you to smile, it conjures up an instruction that you have to do something and it looks really forced. So I would say have a conversation, or if you're working with a pro, what I would do is, as a pro, I would actually just have you move around and talk and laugh, and I'll photograph the in-between moments. So I'll get the in-between smiles, the ones that are really genuine and not the ones that you're forcing.
Talking to Marla Berg, a photographer in Madison and Chicago. She has a studio in downtown Madison. She's sharing advice on posing for all those pictures maybe we're going to be taking as we get back together with friends and family this summer. All right, a big question. When I'm doing photos or when I've been on film for our friends at Wisconsin Public Television, I forget what humans do with their hands What do we do with our hands when we're getting pictures taken?
So that is probably the number one thing that I hear when I'm with the subject. The easiest answer to that is absolutely nothing. So you can just let your hands fall to their sides and use your body to kind of accentuate or, you know, make your arms and hands look good. And what I mean is if you just stay, if you stood up right now and just, you know, stood where you were and your hands fell by their sides, if you put weight on one foot or angled your body in a certain way, your hands will flow. Your elbow might, you know, tilt a little bit. So just kind of let them fall. If letting them fall still feels a bit awkward or unnatural, then I would say go for the pockets. If you're wearing jeans, don't stuff them in the pocket. Maybe just put your thumb in the pocket. Never hide your hands. Never tuck them behind your body. Don't do anything that's too forced. But the easiest answer is let them fall. You could probably watch any actor in any movie and kind of see what they do, and they're letting them fall as well. So it just takes a little bit of practice.
Any advice for getting photos of kids who we might have a hard time getting to pose? So this is advice for the photographers here, I guess, for taking pictures of kids.
Yeah. So kids are my main focus in a lot of my portrait work. And I can tell you, if you're shooting a young kid or, you know, maybe even an adolescent, so someone who's less than 5 feet tall, assuming that you're, you know, around 5 feet or taller, you want to get down to their level. So let's say it's a toddler. You don't want to hold the camera above their heads where you're looking down at them. So this is where you're going to want to squat or kneel or get on the knee, and your lens should be at their head or eye level. The picture looks more natural and in perspective as opposed to being over them. And the other thing I would suggest is don't guide them too much on posing. You may be able to give them direction like lay on your tummy or across your legs. But I tend to not say sit here, stand here, say cheese. I let them be who they are in their natural state, and I just kind of capture the moment.
And just our last few moments, a big group. How do we make sure we get everybody when they're not blinking?
The trick to that is a photographer trick. You just keep shooting a bunch of pictures. So you're going to get some blinkers. Actually, I think there's like a genetic thing with, you know, humans where some just are going to blink more than others. So you got a large group. What I would do is, whether you're using an iPhone or a DSLR, rapid fire, keep shooting. You're going to get something that's good. And if you really have the time, you can probably swap out a few eyes and heads in Photoshop at a later date.
Marla, thanks for the advice. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
That's Marla Berg, a photographer in Madison and Chicago. She joins us today with some advice on how to pose for pictures when we get together with people this summer. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new historical exhibit is telling the stories of immigrants who made their home in the city of Neenah. The Tracing Our Paths exhibit, on display now at the city's Historical Society, highlights residents from the 1850s all the way up to today, looking at their journeys to Wisconsin and how they helped shape their community. Jane Lang is the executive director of the Neenah Historical Society. She talked last week with Central Time producer Dean Knetter.
What was the inspiration behind this exhibit? How did all these stories come together?
Well, it's really, I mean, immigration is a topic that is in the news all the time and has been, obviously, for many years. But what we've really enjoyed doing at the Neenah Historical Society is bringing those national topics down to a local level. I think it's really important for people to understand history, and I think they understand it best when it's right at home. And it literally just brings it home when you talk about a topic like immigration from a local perspective.
And there are a lot of personal stories in this exhibit, but it's also interactive too. Can you paint us a picture of what people can expect when they go there?
Sure. What we did is we have 9 different stories that are featured in the exhibit. And those stories represent immigrants from over the past 170 years, really. But honestly, the first point of the exhibit that we really wanted to make is these immigrants who were arriving from Europe primarily initially they weren't writing on a blank slate. So that's our starting point of the exhibit, is the fact that Native Americans have been living in this area for centuries. And that was something that we felt was really important to include in the exhibit. Then we moved into, you know, the European phase of immigration to this area. So that is the early part of the exhibit. We have five stories featured in that section, really kind of focusing on a variety of people, some people whose names you will recognize even throughout the state, who arrived as immigrants to Nina in the mid-1800s, and then others you might be less familiar with, but nonetheless, their stories were important to our community and how we developed as a community as well. After that initial part of the exhibit, then we talk about the voyage here and what did that look like. I think I can talk more about that in, you know, a different way as we move on, but really the exhibit is kind of focusing on these nine stories as we move through, talking generally about immigration and the patterns that we've had in Nina over the past years. We move into 20th century topics as well, and four individuals who arrived in the 20th century and what their stories were and what their lives were like and what drew them here. So that's kind of an overview of it. In the final part of the exhibit, I really wondered how many people have even seen a naturalization ceremony. So we kind of start talking a little bit more about that, like what is the process and what does it look like when you attend a naturalization ceremony? And also, what is the civics test like? So we have the opportunity for you to take the civics test and see if you would pass it and be qualified to become an American citizen.
And the people profiled in this exhibit, as you mentioned, come from all over, Norway, Germany, Costa Rica, but they all settled in Nina. What are some of the things that drew people to this area specifically over the years?
Well, I think initially, and it, you know, in just a very broad way, obviously, the easy answer to that is what drew people here is the opportunity for a better life. And now, when you try to dig in on that and specifically determine, well, what was it that drew people to this area? Really, I think it was the opportunity for jobs. And the reason we had such a strong manufacturing center in this area was the water power that we have on the Fox River. So that was being harnessed, and it became a very vibrant manufacturing center. So a lot of jobs were created along with that. But really, I mean, what do people look for when they're deciding, you know, do I want to leave my country? What is it? Why are they leaving? They're in a situation that is not positive, and they're looking for better opportunities. So they're looking for jobs, safety, security, and all of those things seem to be in abundance here in the Fox Valley. And also, I think we have just an incredible amount of natural beauty in this area with Lake Winnebago and the Fox River. So that could have been drawing people here as well.
We're talking with Jane Lang, Executive Director of the Nina Historical Society, about the Tracing Our Paths exhibit on display now. And Jane, these journeys that people made, they were not easy. One thing that struck me was written by John Bergstrom from Norway. He had a friend in Menasha he was writing with and asked, hey, is this a good place to move to? He got a positive review and he said, quote, "With no further information, my parents forthwith began preparations for what they knew would be a long journey full of hardships." Paraphrasing a bit there. But people who came here were ready to go, but knew it would be really difficult. Can you talk about some of the difficulties they faced along the way?
Well, in the case of Johannes, who changed his name to John Bergstrom, very difficult, long journey, and his wife nearly died. She was very ill on the journey, and they had two young children. If I'm remembering correctly, they were 3 and 5 years old at the time, two sons. Certainly not an easy journey for them at all. When they arrived, it really was not easier for them, and the jobs were not as plentiful as they'd been led to believe. So it took them quite a while to become comfortable and established in this area. Some of the other people that we featured in the exhibit, particularly those in the, I mean, the 19th century certainly was, the journey here itself was more difficult, so that part was hard. But when you think about adjusting to language barriers and just not the cultural barriers that were present, it's a hard transition, and I think people are leaving behind what they're familiar with. It's got to be incredibly stressful. Our 20th century stories, we focused on a couple of them, were very eye-opening for me, honestly. One of the stories is the story of Zhang Yang, whose family were refugees, Hmong refugees. He happens to be one of only two or a couple, maybe three, of firefighters who are Hmong ancestry in Wisconsin. And it's just been, it was amazing to work with him and find out what his story was and what they went through to get here. And it's so inspirational thinking about how he talks about how hard his parents worked to get here, that it makes them work all the harder to, you know, they know what their parents sacrificed and what they went through to get here. So they want to uphold that tradition and that legacy that their parents have left for them. So another story that we have is that of Curtis Brown, who was a Holocaust survivor. His parents and his sister perished at Auschwitz, and he came to this country in 1947, just after the Holocaust. It's an incredible story. Really, that was the most rewarding part of this exhibit, was talking to the descendants of or the individuals themselves and learning their stories, because really that's what is, it's important to understand the people that we share our community with. So it was a great opportunity to really understand the backgrounds of some of the people that we, you know, we're living with them, we're sharing this community with them. We should get a better understanding of who they are and where they've come from.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Jane, thanks so much for sharing this with us today. Appreciate it.
Well, sure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Jane Lang is the executive director of the Nina Historical Society. She talked to Central Time producer Dean Kinetter about the Tracing Our Paths exhibit. That's on display now through fall of next year, open from 10 a.m. till 2 p.m. on weekdays. You can find out more at ninahistoricalsociety.com.